This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. As a kid in California, Nadia Orton never felt all that connected with her family on the East Coast. There were a bunch of cousins and all those old people she couldn't quite keep straight, but that all changed when she needed help the most. When she got sick, it was her elders who came through and saved her life. Nadia embarked on a quest to honor her family. She set out to trace her lineage and find her ancestors' final resting places. That was complicated by the woeful state of many African-American cemeteries in the South. Her search turned into a mission and a passion to save the sacred spaces where her ancestors rest. Through her research, Nadia has since visited hundreds of cemeteries, and she helps other families uncover their own histories. And she joins me now on the State of Things. Nadia Orton, welcome. Good to talk with you.
Good to see you, too.
I want to talk a little bit about your growing up in Oakland, California, right? And I guess at a young age, you impressed your teachers with your zeal. You were overwriting. The rest of us were saying 200 words, and does it count conjunctions? But not you. You actually overwrote most of your essays. Am I right?
Yes, I was actually kind of surprised. I was being seen as the nerdy kid or one of the top kids in class. And so one day, one of my teachers, an English teacher, asked to see me after class. And I remember feeling embarrassed because the whole room stared. Like, what did she do? But actually, he just wanted to say, and it was very hard for him to admit, that I wrote too much. You know, I went way over the limit for the essay. And I remember thinking, how could you ever write too much? But it was something that definitely wasn't hard for me.
And you always had a sense that there was history, I guess, was something that was interesting to you. But you learned from your father that maybe you weren't getting the entire history from class.
Yeah, I remember growing up seeing a lot of books around our house about Black history, African-American history, diaspora history, and I remember seeing that a lot of those that weren't covered in the classes that I was taking in school. So one thing that, even though I grew up in California, which was one of the best public education centers in the world, they made sure that I knew about the lost stories and people I'd never heard of before that honestly I thought should have been a part of the curriculum, but it wasn't. So just along the way, as I read and researched different topics, they would always say, well, make sure you read this about Ida B. Wells, or make sure you know about Marcus Garvey, just to make sure that I knew exactly what all was out there still to find. And I knew growing up that there was still a lot of research to be done.
And lucky for you, you didn't mind doing the research and writing all about it. So that you were prepared at a very early age. Talk about your parents. Your dad was a union organizer, right?
Yes, he worked for the Kellogg Corporation out in San Leandro. And he was a union organizer as well as employee there. And my mother was self-employed. She was very independent that way. And so she had her own business in medical transcription. And between the two, I guess I had very good examples growing up about what it meant to be strong and independent and follow what you think is right to do.
Yeah, and a good sense of history and what to look for and how to find those things that may have been left out. So what did that mean for you as before you went to college, or did you have a sense of what it was you wanted to do?
Actually, I did. I didn't have to really think about it. I'd always been drawn to history and biographies of people. Not so much fiction, but also myths and legends. I remember getting, I don't know if anyone remembers, but in the early 80s, they had something called the World Book. It was kind of a children's encyclopedia. Mm-hmm. And I remember they came once a month. It was a different topic every month, but it was almost like a Jelly of the Month Club. Mm-hmm. But in this case, all of them were good. So I remember thinking, you know, the new one's coming and what can I learn about? And I remember being drawn to those specific topics very clearly, folklore and myths and legends, but at the same time, history and anthropology. I was just naturally drawn to those two subjects. And I think now maybe with the folklore, it was in the stories.
Yeah, well, story certainly is attractive to anyone, but I'm wondering, too, if you even intuited at the time or knew at the time that those myths do tell a deeper story and a deeper truth about people that can be informed by objective timelines, but that the deeper truth is really found in those mythical stories.
Exactly.
So you decided to go to Duke, huh?
Yes, I actually tried to apply to different colleges around the country, and out of the 16 I applied for, I got into 14. But somehow, again, maybe it was precognition, I'm not sure, but I like Duke's campus. I like that it was a beautiful campus, of course, but I also like that it was surrounded by black colleges and universities like North Carolina Central. So I thought I could go to Duke University, but I could also learn about the history of the area in terms of its black history, and go to some of the HBCUs that were around.
You studied African and African American studies at Duke, is that right?
Yes, along with political science.
And also you had a fair amount of family. Your family had moved out to, your immediate family had moved out to California, but a lot of your extended family was here in the South, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was that something you did also deliberately, thought about that with regard to Duke, you'd be closer to them, or was that less a part of your thinking at the time?
Well, at the time when I started going to Duke, I thought that most of my family heritage lay in Virginia, in Tidewater, Virginia. That's, I knew that my mother's side, a lot of the relatives had moved out to San Leandro and Oakland, but I thought that in terms of history in our family, it was mostly tied to Portsmouth. And I only learned later just how much that we had family roots on both sides in North Carolina.
You also, at the time, this is when you developed lupus, am I right?
Yes, when I was 14 years old.
And that really, because you were so active and involved in music and other things, that had some pretty serious consequences for you at the time. Talk about what it was like for you to learn that you had it and how you learned that you had lupus.
Well, it was the strangest thing. I was taking, I was actually playing the flute and piccolo in my high school band or orchestra, and I would notice from time to time in the mornings that my fingers were swollen, and it would go away. It was temporary, and then it would stop, and I thought at the time, maybe it's just because I was doing too much, or I hadn't had enough sleep the night before. I was playing an open-hold flute, so maybe it was stress on my joints. There are all these different possibilities that I thought of, and besides, it would go away. So I thought maybe I just need to dial it down, get more rest, but then the swelling, it just occurred more and more. And finally, I just knew I had a feeling something was wrong.
What are some of the other symptoms? As this develops now, you're going to go, you're at 14 when you first learn about lupus. Mm-hmm. Did it affect you much in college?
It did, a lot. One of the main things was chronic fatigue. And having a rigorous course schedule like you have at Duke University, there never seems to be enough hours in the day, but I remember that was the biggest struggle sometimes, with just being very, very tired. And it's one of the hallmark ramifications of what it means to have systemic lupus. And my lupus was actually one of the more serious kind. There are many different versions. It affects everyone differently. But mine concentrated in my kidneys, and it was officially called lupus nephritis. And so I had to get regular blood tests. The doctor's side or the medical side of the university, they saw me a lot. And often had to ask me if I was an employee or a student. Mm. But I remember just having to do that all the time, and I just realized every time I was around my friends in college that they didn't have that type of experience, but I did.
And eventually, go ahead.
Yeah, and having to figure out how to group my class schedule so I could actually accomplish what I needed to. Mm. And I actually had to group them on 2 days out of the week, Tuesdays and Thursdays. So I would have Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and the weekend to recuperate. And so it was a tough struggle.
Yeah, because as you say, it affected your kidney. And eventually you had to go on dialysis, right?
Yes, actually right after I graduated. It was about 6 months after my graduation. And being concentrated in my kidneys at first, it kind of, in a way, I say it completed its job. It kind of ruined my kidneys, and so I was diagnosed with end-stage renal disease in 2000 and had to immediately go on dialysis 3 days a week.
At that point, your doctors are recommending a transplant, but that's going to be a very difficult and an expensive operation, right?
Very expensive, and just getting into that, I didn't realize how much of the process was driven by financial considerations, by money. It was just very new, and I thought I kind of knew how to handle tough medical situations being diagnosed with lupus so young. But the transplant was a completely different level, and having to be on dialysis for 4 years before I could actually raise the amount of money that was necessary, it was over $20,000.
And they had a recommendation for you for how you could go about at least starting to raise that money, right?
The transplant center in Atlanta, Georgia, they recommended that I write a letter to everyone and anyone that I knew asking for help. On the one hand, for a transplant, if they wanted to possibly donate, and definitely for the financial considerations. And honestly, it was, I think, out of everything, it was the hardest letter I've ever had to write.
We'll find out why that letter was so difficult and what kind of response she got. It was a response that ultimately turned her life around and got her directed in the area and on the mission that she is on right now. Nadia Orton is my guest, public historian, professional genealogist. We'll talk more about her quest to find cemeteries from Africa for African Americans, mostly in the South, what she has found and what she has learned. You'll hear about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Nadia Orton suffered from lupus, which seriously damaged her kidney. She spent 12 hours a week hooked up to a dialysis machine and the rest trying to get up the energy to run an errand. She had the financial and emotional support of her elders, so when Nadia finally got a second chance at living a healthy life, she felt compelled to pay it forward. She has since visited more than 400 cemeteries, and what began as a commitment to find her own family has blossomed into a passion for helping others trace their lineage and to save African-American cemeteries. So, Nadia, before the break, you talked about having to write this letter asking for help, both the potential donor and also financial support from family and friends. And you said it was the most difficult part of the whole illness. Why? What was difficult?
Well, I really like to think of myself as a more private person. And so having to write that letter asking for that specific kind of help, basically asking if someone will donate an organ so you can survive, or money to pay for a transplant for a donor for someone else. And it just really felt like I was putting myself completely out there. I felt very vulnerable. And it was kind of frightening to have to do that. Just to survive, but it's what I had to do, so I managed to write it. But again, it was just such a hard process being just so open and vulnerable, knowing that a lot of people would read it and maybe say no or not respond, because how would you react once you got a letter like that from someone?
Well, how did they react?
Honestly, a lot of them I didn't hear back. I didn't hear any kind of response, and these were all people that I knew, and I knew they cared about me and my family, and I thought I can't think negative or negatively about them for not responding, because I thought, what would I do myself if I got that letter? I might not respond just because I was scared to think about donating an organ, and then I wouldn't know how to tell that person, you know? So when I didn't hear back from a lot of people, I thought that's probably what happened. But at the same time, it felt very isolating to have that kind of silence after writing that kind of letter. I can't be dishonest. It did feel very lonely.
Eventually, though, you did get a reply, one that, as we say, kind of set you on the path. Talk about that envelope you received from Aunt Phil.
Well, like I said, I sent out letters to almost everybody I knew, and some didn't answer at all. Some did, responding with checks for $100, $250, all of it I was grateful for. But after a while, it seemed like the letters stopped, and I thought, that's probably the last time I'm going to hear from anybody. Maybe I need to move to another phase. And it seemed like once there was a delay of about a month, I got this very large packet in the mail, a big manila envelope. And I remember thinking, is this some kind of magazine? It was so thick. And it had my name on it, and I saw that it came from Portsmouth, Virginia, from my grandaunt, Phil Gridor Rachel Orton Duke. And I thought, well, maybe it's a get well card. What is this? And the way I opened it, it just seemed like everything fell out on the floor. But I saw at first there were a lot of checks, and there were different checks. There were checks from different people, people I'd never met before. And I saw they referred various amounts. It didn't matter how big or small, but I thought, what in the world? And then I saw a letter, so I opened it up. And I still remember thinking, I just scanned it. I didn't quite read it because I couldn't believe it. And it said, "Hi, you know, grandniece, this is your Aunt Phil. I'm sure you don't remember me. We met at family reunions years ago when I was little. And I got your letter, and I spent the last month trying to help you out. I went to my church, and I made an announcement, and I basically said, you need to help my grandniece." And she was a, I'll just say that my grandaunt Phil, she was someone that you paid attention to. If she said, do this, people did it. So I thought she went to her entire church, and everyone gave. And I was under no illusions that it was so much about me. It was how much they respected her and her legacy, her life, what she'd done for the community. She ran daycare. She cared for people. And part of that legacy of hers was going to her church, and they helped her because that's what she did for everybody else. So I benefited from her lifetime of generosity to her community.
How well did you know her at that point?
I wanted to know her a lot better by then.
Well, you did eventually, but let's talk about this. Ultimately, you do get a second, you get a chance, and you get put on the list. And even that, I mean, there's a story around how you almost missed an opportunity there, right?
Yeah, and it was kind of a terrible day because I've been through the kidney evaluations that they make any potential transplant recipient go through. I thought I knew the steps. I kept my dialysis schedule. And the nurses in the center, they kind of took me under their wing because I was the youngest person in that dialysis center. And it didn't help that I look half my age anyway. So they were looking out for me. And they said, you know, these calls can come at any time, so always be prepared. And I said, okay. But my first call, it came at 5 in the morning, and I missed it. I was deep asleep. Lupus and dialysis, it plays havoc with your hormones and everything else. So I often had trouble sleeping, so I was in probably a pretty deep sleep. And I remember everyone said, you know, the nurses at the transplant center, they called and called about 30 times. They really tried, but I just missed it. And by the time I got the call and answered their message, the kidney had gone to another hospital, and they wouldn't release it.
You did get a second chance, though.
I did. I was very mad about about missing that call, mad at myself. But I thought, I have to go on. You know, maybe I'll get another call. And once I decided to firmly put myself back, you know, on the road and just look forward and be positive, about 3 weeks after I missed the first call, I got another one. And that was the kidney that I received.
What condition were you in? I'm trying to imagine your state after you missed that call. How critical was your situation in terms of needing that kidney then? I mean, obviously you could stay on dialysis for a while. But what was the prognosis for you at that point as we imagine you missing this vital phone call?
Well, I try to always take care of myself and abide by everything the doctor said so I would have the best possible success with dialysis. It's a very tough procedure. Basically, it's cleansing your blood outside of your body through a machine, but it would often have me feeling like lead, you know, after the procedures, more like filtering your soul through the machine. And so I think my emotional state, it took the hardest hit missing that call. I was always going to keep following my regimen, but I felt devastated when I missed the first one.
You did stick with it. There was a second one, and you were able to have the transplant, and things turned around for you. And then your life changed again when your Aunt Phil was sick, and you were able to go visit her. Tell us about that visit.
Well, I never really got a chance to see her before she passed. That was my father. And it occurred only 3 years after I got my transplant in 2004. So this is in 2007 that she got very sick. And my father was there by her bedside the day she died. And one of the lasting things she said was that she was concerned about our family history dying. She literally said those words. And I think she was thinking about me being out first in California, and then we moved back to the East Coast as I went to college. But us just getting split up and the cousins not really staying in contact with each other as much as her generation did. And it was something my father made sure that he told me when he came back from her funeral, that that was one of the last things she'd said, and kind of taking it to her grave, that maybe we lose sense of who we are as a family. And once I heard that, thinking about everything she'd done for me in a very recent time period, I thought, this is the exact thing that I'm going to do for her. I have to.
It's interesting because she didn't mention you by name. She didn't say, you know, go tell Nadine here's what she must do. But when you heard it, you took it as a commission.
Oh, yes. And it wasn't so much, you know, I have to do it or no one else in the family could do it. But it was something that I thought in my heart, I'm going to do what I can to help.
So what do you do when the mission is to not let the family history die? Where do you start?
Well, I started with an elder. One of my grandaunt Phil's children, her full name was Belvedere Sunita Orton Duke Andrews. She was the griot of the family. And the first thing I thought after asking around for very good advice from other people was that to start with an elder. Start with a person who knows all the stories. Start there. And so that's what I did, was I finally had a chance to get to Portsmouth and sit down with my cousin, my first cousin, Belvedere, and learn everything I could from her to get going.
What was she telling you?
A lot of the names of all of the ancestors that I had met, relatives that had passed on before I was born, very key were their nicknames. A lot of people in the African-American community, they might have a given name, but sometimes they're more known colloquially by a shorter name or a nickname. And so I heard all of those full names, the given names, the nicknames, and I could use those to start using census records and the more typical documentation that genealogists use to trace family history.
And you did that, and you found some surprisingly good records, at least when you started. Talk about some of the surprising results. And in fact, also this search led you to North Carolina, where you had a fair number of ancestors, right, and family members.
Yeah, that was two of the most surprising things were I had no idea that a lot of people on my father's side of the family were born free. And I was able to trace them back to the early 1600s because people that were born free of slavery, there was at least some documentation that you could use to find them. Tax records, listings. One of the most disturbing things was that they always had to register with a local county courthouse to basically state their free status. And they had to have those certificates on them at all times, or else they could be imprisoned or sold back into slavery without them. But the good side was that I was actually able to find them, even though those records to me were somewhat negative. And the second was that I had no idea that even on my father's side, including my mother's, that we had so much family history in North Carolina. I hadn't heard that before.
Some of those roots were in Como, North Carolina, right in Hertford County?
Mm-hmm. That's what my cousin Belvedere told me. And she said, all of this, all of our family goes back to Como. And she just kind of left it hanging like that. And so that prompted me to ask her, what is Como? I'd never heard of it before. And I thought, okay, I'd heard about this at a family reunion when I was 9. But I was 9 and hadn't really paid much attention to it. But I thought, the Van Clan and Como, here it is again. And I said, okay, now it matters to me. But I still didn't know where it was. And so that was one of the first things we did for a family road trip, was go to Como.
What kind of findings did you make? Because I know ultimately, not ultimately, but along the way, you discovered also ancestors who fought in the Civil War for the Union, and you know, found out a little bit about their story as well. Is that right?
Exactly. That was also a very nice find, because I remembered when the movie Glory came out in 1989. It was actually the same year that I'd been diagnosed with lupus, but it was such a beautiful movie, and I always sob every time I see it, even now. But finding out that we had so many ancestors that were born enslaved, that escaped, took all those risks for themselves, you know, to fight for their community, to fight for freedom. And to think now about being so young, seeing that movie and having no idea that people in our own family did the same thing, it's just been an amazing experience.
You talked about finding some records and, you know, being able to piece together the family story. What got you going when starting to visit cemeteries?
Well, that was one of the first things that actually, her nickname was Belvie, but my first cousin Belvedere, the family griot, told me to do. She said, one thing that maybe you can help us with is, even though I'm giving you all these names to get started, one thing that we haven't been able to do here is visit the family cemetery, and that was shocking. I thought, they've lived here their entire lives. What do you mean that you can't go? And that's when they told us that it's overgrown, it's dangerous, there's snakes, there's feral dogs. It's so overgrown, the grass is waist high, we can't even see where our family gravestones are. And it was horrifying for me to hear that. And so one of the first things I wanted to do beyond finding Como was to look at the family cemeteries. I just couldn't believe that maybe me coming in, being so new to family history, that this was something I could help them with in the immediate, was to make a physical trek to our family's ancestral grave sites. And once upon getting there, I realized exactly what they meant. I saw flooding, I saw vandalized gravestones, I saw pieces of gravestones all over the place, looking like they were scattered from the original location. And I found some of our family's monuments, and they looked like someone had taken a sledgehammer to them. And beyond being angry, I thought, this is something that we need to start doing right now, is to try to fix these gravestones or find our family's burial sites immediately, you know, to maybe stop any of the damage that's still occurring. And I think that's where I got my start, was even then, was just being shocked at the state of the cemetery once you first find it, thinking it'll look like all the other cemeteries you've seen that are historically white cemeteries, and seeing just how much the black cemeteries seem like they did not get the same attention or care or money or support from local city governments.
You've ended up at this point visiting over 400 cemeteries. How do you describe the conditions? Are they, in general, are many of them in the same condition? Are some in better shape than others?
In general, if the cemetery is well cared for, it seems like it's also part of a community that hasn't been destroyed. I know a lot of people look at cemeteries now as a site to protect, but I always came into looking at black cemeteries for what they were originally, as some of the first institutions in black communities that were necessary to form because of segregation. They were trying to find a dignified place to bury their people with respect. And seeing a lot of cemeteries look so terrible, I automatically thought, well, what's going on with the surrounding community? Hmm. And it would seem to match. You know, the cemeteries would look bad, but then you see the surrounding community had been disturbed in different ways, whether it was because of highways being plotted right through black communities, lack of jobs, lack of resources, the kind of job my father had, even as a union rep at the Kellogg's plant in Oakland, all of those jobs were disappearing. And so you see, it seems like the community is going through almost being attacked in a way. Its sanctity is under threat. And you would see that directly in the correlation with the cemetery and its condition. And so if a cemetery was part of a community that was being, I'd say, destroyed because of family bonds being severed, you think about all the different reasons why, most of them economic, those cemeteries were in poor condition. but cemeteries connected to, say, a church that had a healthy congregation and there's some stability in that region, that cemetery would be better taken care of because the families were still there and they still had resources. So it kind of made sense to see which ones were very neglected and overgrown and which ones looked a little bit better. It was all because of the condition of the community around it.
We're talking to Nadia Orton, a public historian, professional genealogist, and one who has visited hundreds of cemeteries as she works to find honor for her ancestors. Our conversation will continue on the state of things in just a few moments. Please stay with us. This is State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. We often think of cemeteries as places where we find neat rows of headstones, sculptures, and plaques. Few of the cemeteries Nadia Orton has visited look that way. African-American cemeteries in the South are often overgrown, unmapped, and unadorned, but to Nadia, that doesn't make them less sacred. She started visiting cemeteries in a quest to find and remember her own family. That quest has blossomed into a passion for preserving cemeteries and helping others honor their loved ones. We were talking, Nadia, about the fact that you have been visiting many, many of these cemeteries. In fact, I understand that you're always ready. You've got your boots and protective gear in the car just in case you pass a cemetery. Am I right?
Yes. my family is very used to that by now. Wherever we go, they know that I'm going to either see one that they're trying to whiz by or I've already documented it as some place to go. And that's my little cemetery toolkit that I have to have.
What's in the toolkit?
Well, the things you'd expect, things like bug spray to keep away the mosquitoes and the ticks, and gloves, things like that, to possibly clear away grime that you might see on the headstones or lichen so you can read the names. But also, I was actually glad I saw it. It was something, I think, on Animal Planet a while ago. But there were two guys that were, I think, rattlesnake wranglers or something. that seemed crazy, but I was interested in what they were doing. But one thing stuck out, and they said actually old cemeteries are snakes' favorite habitat. And I really paid attention to that because I hadn't thought of that before and thought how many times I've been gone crunching through dried beds of leaves and such, and something could have been under there. And I got lucky. So from that point on, and it was also driven by family, they said there's no way you're going to keep going out to these cemeteries without snake boots. And I think I probably found the longest snake stick possible. It's about 10 feet, so much taller than me, but I'm glad I have those things now. So definitely anybody going out, you have to be aware that as much history there is to find and how amazing the finds can be, you also have to really make sure that you're aware of your surroundings.
Yeah, and you found that out, not necessarily while you were doing your search, because you're really involved in your research, but after the fact, looking at some photographs, am I right?
Yes, and I guess he'll find out about it now, but my father didn't know. I didn't want to tell him or any of the other older males in the family that were worried about such things. I'd see things like beds of ivy, and obviously if you can't see where you're going, you shouldn't step there. But I kind of would sense that there could be something in there, so I'd zoom in with my camera, and getting home and developing the pictures, I'd see them after the fact. They were sitting right there. And so I knew better not to do it at the time, but yes, it's just one has to take care of one's surroundings as you try to rediscover history.
You know, with regard to your father maybe finding out, let me just tell you this. They know you, Nadia, and they know that that wouldn't stop you anyway, so they probably guessed. So you haven't you haven't burned anything yet.
Oh,
but,
good.
But snakes are not always the most dangerous things. I mean, not everybody is so welcoming. Talk about the time you paid a visit to one place where you talked to a landowner who was a little surprised when you actually got there.
Yes, I always try to give credit where it's due, and a lot of people have obviously done a lot of cemetery preservation work before I started, but I was very happy to see that one day in Warren County, southern Warren County, North Carolina, someone had actually seen the gravestone of my second great-grandmother, who was born enslaved. And I thought, based on where she was living, it being a rural area, that I would probably never find her gravestone, because unlike city cemeteries or town cemeteries, the ones out in the country, could often be behind someone's house, or it could be just at some point in the road, and all a death certificate might say was, you know, the person died in such and such county. And so I thought, well, maybe her gravesite's on the back burner, but then this woman found it, and so I asked her help to help connect me to the landowner so we could get permission. That's always required. And I think maybe he interpreted the way that we were talking or the way we sounded on the phone as not being African American, because when we actually showed up, he was very friendly on the phone, but it was quite different when we arrived. He came out of his door, I could see at the top of the stairs of his house, and he froze. And I thought, just in reading his body language, I thought, oh, okay, he didn't exactly know that we were black. And I was thinking about how do you go on from here? We're sitting here right in his face. And my mother said, well, he knows we are now. You know, in other words, like, we're already here. We're not going to go back. And I said, you're right. You know, so he has to deal with it. But that's just one of the other things that you run into as an African-American genealogist. It's not only just sometimes harder history to find because of the ramifications of slavery and segregation, Jim Crow, but, you know, obviously now things aren't perfect, and many of those things have remained in terms of the view of African Americans and being lesser. So it's something that you encounter quite often. Actually, it's not just in the South, but sometimes you have to really read a situation and carefully proceed, I'll say.
We've also had some situations just in trying to uncover documents that have demonstrated to you that not everybody is interested in getting this history revealed.
No, because that's been one of the tough lessons to learn as well. I didn't want to think that maybe I was to blame for it completely, but there's some situations we've been in where we would go to a courthouse and start looking through deeds, older deeds. And I remember so many paralegals and attorneys coming through trying to look at my notes pretty rudely, like they were trying to see what I was doing there. And in one situation, I think I mistakenly wore my college sweatshirt into the deed area because within 30 days of that visit, they decided to burn most of their original deeds that were dated before or prior to 1800. But, and the excuse at the time was that they were covered with mold, but I thought, this is within an hour of Duke University and University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. There are ways that they could have tried to save those records, and they didn't really even take a first step to do so. They just burned them.
Why do you think they were so interested in burning them and destroying them?
I think what it said to me is that despite the use of the excuse of mold, I think they were really worried that maybe African Americans would start coming in and not even just have a curiosity to learn about the past, but maybe even steps might be taken to rectify the injustices of that past. I could think of no other reason why you would take something that was so precious to so many people, black and white, and, you know, somebody African American shows up in the deed area a few times and you burn them.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know what else that, I don't really know how else that speaks.
Fear of reconciling the past.
Yes, you know. Exactly.
Tell us about finding your long-lost relative, though, Alexandra Wharton. That had to be a great moment for you.
Well, again, it was almost like my second great-grandmother's grave in the slave cemetery that we found. Alexandra's grave was located in a section in Virginia, actually, that other people had said had been destroyed by highway work. They said, all that's gone now, when I asked about it. And I thought, no, because I just found out what he did. I mean, to me, he was Denzel Washington in glory. Mm-hmm. But he was in our family. And so I thought, I'm stubborn. That's a family trait. I decided to go out there anyway and see, well, where was it? You know, if it's gone, then at least maybe it can be marked in some way after the fact. And when I went out to the area, they said the church was there that he helped found. And I thought, well, maybe they know something. And I didn't think to look first in the cemetery there because so many people said those graves are gone. But in talking to the groundskeeper of the church, I noticed he had a hand-drawn map of this church's cemetery behind him on the wall. And even though I was doing my best to listen to him and be nice, I kept looking over his head thinking, maybe I can see Alexander's name. And the man was very nice and started to wonder what I was looking at. I think he thought I saw a spider or something. But I remember yelping at one point because I'd seen it. It was a hand-drawn map. In 20 of those spots, one of them was Alexander Orton. I thought, my third great-grandfather's right outside, and I think it was all I could do to try to stay in his office while getting that out, saying, we really need to go outside because I just found my ancestor.
But
it was due to his help,
yeah,
of course.
Because I guess he had taken it on himself to draw that map, right? Is that right?
Yeah, he told us. He said, we never really thought about it. I'm new to the job, but someone like you came through here, and they were wondering who was out there, so I thought, let me go see. And so he did that on his own. And so, again, to that church janitor, thank you so very much. But it's in those ways that people can do something that's so profound for family history, and they think they're not really doing anything at all. And all of those efforts matter.
You found out that you also, that he had a brother, that Alexander had a brother, Daniel, right? But you weren't able to find him.
No, and that was another sad part of our history. Nobody had ever heard of Daniel Orton before I started my research. And I thought, I can't believe it, but Alexander had a brother that was also in the United States Colored Troops. And he was actually part of the 1st Regiment U.S. Colored Infantry. And while Alexander had escaped and gone over to Portsmouth from what used to be called Nansemond County, which is now Suffolk, Daniel had managed to get all the way to Washington, D.C. I really don't know how he did that, but he managed to enlist all the way up there coming from Lower Suffolk City. And he was actually killed, though, on the first day of the Siege of Petersburg on June 15, 1864. And his body had never really been recovered. It's never been identified to this day.
In researching him, though, you did find out and were able to identify the headstone of Alfred Savage. Tell us about him.
Well, Alfred Savage, he was one of the mysteries that I encountered in an ancestral cemetery. I knew that he was a United States Colored Troop, and so I was determined to find out who it was, in part being excited by finding Alexander, but also disappointed in not finding Daniel Orton. And so I thought I couldn't find Daniel, but I want to find all the others that I can simply because I know how disappointing it is to lose an ancestor in a way. And so Alfred's gravestone was very faded just from erosion and the elements, and it was very hard to read. And so I took my finger one day and just traced the letters on the gravestone, and I was able to figure out his name and then started doing a study of his family history. And I was able to find a few living descendants, even though they were living in Ohio. And so I contacted one who was a dentist, and he said, actually, I'm glad that you reached out to me because we have family that are looking into our past. And he put me in touch with a cousin in Atlanta, or outside of Atlanta, Georgia. And then that cousin told me that they had an elder who actually lived in Portsmouth, Virginia. And he was actually only 10 minutes away from us at the time and about 15 minutes away from the cemetery. And so on his 89th birthday, I was able to take him out there to help him find his ancestor. And he himself told me how happy he was because, again, like people in my family, like my cousin Belvedere told me years before, he had not been able to visit the cemetery either because it was so overgrown. And he had forgotten where Alfred was buried, but we rediscovered him that day together.
So obviously by now your whole mission had branched out beyond your family to bring other families together to help preserve and identify other cemeteries. What kind of efforts are you making now to save and protect cemeteries?
Well, it's various. I try to do as much research as I can, replacing military headstones once I figure out the identities. I also like working with a lot of groups that are dedicated to preserving Black history. Here in North Carolina, I'm a member of the Phoenix Historical Society of Edgecombe County, and they do a wonderful job of securing and making sure everyone knows about very key aspects of African-American history that would otherwise go unknown, especially through the placement of historical markers. I also work with different cemetery preservation groups, and there's one in Suffolk I work with directly now. Preserving a Black History, the Oaklawn Cemetery in Suffolk. And also in Richmond, I work with the Enrichment Foundation to help preserve Evergreen Cemetery. But in general, it's just to do whatever I can in different ways, whether it's research, finding descendants, preserving gravestones as I can, getting them listed in national registers. It's all connected, but it's all part of the one goal that I have, is to pay it forward. And again, so many people did so much for me when I really needed help and felt like I had nowhere to go. It's all I can do to give back to everybody and anyone how I can, and I happen to love doing historical research, so it seems like a natural fit.
Well, it's obviously a very personal story at one level for you, as you talked about paying it forward. It dovetails beautifully with your love for research and in your family, pulling them together and then bringing other families. You can see how this expands. But it seems to me that this is important at a very, very much larger level, which is to make sure that we all know the whole history of our place and not just one that might be represented by a single monument in the town square, because other histories are obliterated. As you suggest, courthouses are actually burning records. They're so afraid of what we might find. Why is this so important, do you think, and on a larger level, that we pay attention to these things and preserve them?
Well, again, I often see cemeteries now as what they were originally created to be, which were institutions. And they were very important to the community. And when you see just how much the community can be fractured even today, they might be the last tangible links to a people, to a person, to history that creates more of an authentic narrative of who we are as Americans. And I think the longer that it goes without saying that you don't preserve these sites, you'll never know exactly who created and who added what to who we are. And so, like I said, it's very valuable history, but can be very fragile. And it's almost a crisis level where you think there's so much that can be that can go missing if you don't preserve it. And so I think it's incumbent upon everyone who values family, values true history, to look around and see which ways they can contribute. And this is just one way that I choose to do so.
Nadia Orton, professional genealogist and public historian, thank you so much.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
You can find out more about our work and our show at our website, stateofthings.org. Also, sign up for our newsletter and get a daily preview of the lineup. Our show is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.